I think we will all be speaking about road creation over the next few days, so I thought I would make sure to point out that I am too. This is work that I did with Ted Jacobson at the University of Maryland. You can find it online and so forth. I think that everything I will say will be unquestionable, and therefore we will have no problems staying on schedule.
You just give the facts, right?
That's right. So if there is a cutoff on fundamental degrees of freedom, then as the universe expands, the number of degrees of freedom must increase. The question then arises, how do you formulate the dynamics of a theory in the context where the number of degrees of freedom is growing? This led Ted and I to examine quantum field theory on a lattice, which the number of points on the lattice is increasing. So we examined the construction of the classical and quantum theories for a very simple model, massless scalar field, on a background lattice in which the number of points grows. Because the number of points increases, the dimension of the space of initial data that you have to specify increases, and therefore the number of independent field modes also increases. In our case, we have nothing to say about the mechanism that enforces the cutoff. We also did not consider any dynamics of the lattice, so we just have a fixed background structure, and we throw this field theory on it. I won't say too much about the structure of...
When you say a fixed background structure, there's a space between the points. Does the theory have in it the degrees of freedom that can probe in that small space? Or the only probes that you have are the oscillations of material from point to point? So you don't use the background space?
No. There's no back... the lattice
because you said there's a background space.
The lattice is not embedded in a background space. It's just a set of... finite set of points.
Right.
And each point, there's a number associated with that point, which is the value of the scalar field. Let me say a few things about the lattice is that we considered. The secondary motivation for the work was to define quantum field theory on a causal set, a general causal set. But that turned out to be too hard. A causal set, I think we'll hear more about it later, but basically you have set discrete points and links between the points that describe more null directions rather than space-like directions. So in our case, we have lattices with discrete time steps, and at each time step, there's a set of points. And the links on the lattice don't connect the points at each time step, rather they connect the points at different time steps. So we restricted to lattices where we had links between, the links only connect points at one step with the immediate future and immediate past. So this is my schematic drawing of one of the lattices. You have a bunch of points, and there are a lot of little red links connecting the different points. So what I'll do is go briefly through the construction of the classical theory, which involves finding the field equation in the classical phase space and a symplectic structure on the phase space, which is a anti-symmetric bilinear mapping, which is another way of saying a covariant way of defining the Poisson brackets of linear observables on the phase space. This gives us an algebra of observables, which we can then promote to now an algebra of quantum observables. And this defines quantum theory once you define a set of states on that algebra. We also wanted to make sure that the theory was concrete enough to do something with it. And so we considered a very simple model where we have a two-dimensional universe, well, one plus one-dimensional universe. It goes through a brief period of growth. And we asked, what is the particle creation induced by the growth? That leads to the question of how you define particles in this setting. Because of the increase of degrees of freedom, evolution of initial data through a growth event, or as I call it here, a birth event, is not unique. So if you define something like, if you're able to define something like a harmonic mode that suggests a particle interpretation at early times, well, it can grow into all sorts of different solutions at later times. The net effect is that there are a whole lot of different states that seem to be a good in vacuum. So we have to figure out how to specify the different types of vacuums and what the physical effect of the different choices are. Roughly speaking, the different choices don't matter. There are always a lot of in particles in the out vacuum and vice versa. And we seem to find that there was, in general, a Planckian density of energy, which is just too much. More than we would observe if you extrapolate our model up into four dimensions.
The Planck mass is the inverse time interval.
Yeah, I should have. That was not clear on my case. By Planckian density, I just meant on the order of the spacing on the lattice. Okay. So let me tell you about the classical theory. The way we set about defining this, the way we set about to define the theory was to define an action for the scalar field on the lattice. Given an action, you can vary it to obtain a field equation, and you can also obtain a symplectic structure through a subtle trick of varying the action but keeping it and looking at the boundary terms. In this case, the boundary being time-like, space-like layers of the lattice. I won't tell you what the action we actually defined was because the details of it are not really important for the general scheme of things. What is important is that we get a wave equation that's discrete, of course, and is second order and implicit. Here, this means we relate data at three time steps is related, so you could imagine specifying initial data consisting of field values at two different times and solving for the values at the third time. But the equation is implicit, which means you can't actually, in general, solve it to give you the values at single points. You can't solve the field equation. The evolution, the implicitness.
Are the field equations of second order?
Yeah.
A second order different equations in space and time.
Yeah.
And when you say that at each point you have a number of field values, does it mean that you're doing first quantization? You're not having operators at the points?
Well, at this point it's simply it's totally classical.
But why can't you solve them if you know psi I and each point and each point also the difference between psi I plus 1 and psi I, so you know the value and the derivative? If you say that finite, the difference equations are still not solvable.
You know, right. Let me just draw an example, a lattice that say there's 2 points at one step and then 3 points at the next, and then keep 3 points.
Oh.
And now the links might be something like this.
Yeah.
Some very strange thing. And now what I was saying about implicit is that if I give you the values of the fields at these two time steps, you, in general, can't write down what the value is at this point in terms of these values.
Yeah. Can't you produce an algorithm which will do it? Well, when you produce a new point,
Sure, you can produce an algorithm, but there's no unique algorithm. In fact, that's what I was trying to say at the next, as my next point. The data, evolution of the data is not unique in general. It exists. Either backwards or forwards in time. And it may not exist. In particular, if you try to evolve backwards to a time when there are fewer points, the evolution, then you in a sense have constraints on the data that you have to satisfy. Explicit form of the equation depends on the links. So the value of the field equation for this point depends on how many other points it's linked to. And so the form of the equation can be changed by changing the links. The symplectic product is, as I said, an anti-symmetric function on the space of solutions. This is conserved. Here, phi and psi are two configurations that satisfy the field equations. At this point, you can imagine they satisfy it just within some finite region on the lattice, finite set of time steps. The product is conserved as long as psi and phi are evolved in that region according to equations of motion. So, in order to define the quantum theory based on this classical setup we have, we chose to follow the algorithm described by Bob Wald in his little red book on quantum field theory and curved spacetime, which is so wonderfully abstract that you really just need to define a classical a linear vector space that you call your phase space, and a symplectic product on that space, and you have everything. The procedure for doing that involves a lot of state, sort of magical incantations about what it means to define an algebra and things like that. But basically, those are the two ingredients you must have, and everything follows from there. So the point is, what do we define as the vector, the phase space here?
Can I just make one comment?
Yeah.
Jack? I mean, what motivated us to sort of take that abstract point of view is we immediately faced the question of what's a canonically quantized field on a structure like this? We can't just make up out of the blue canonical commutation relations that are some discrete analog of the continuum ones and expect them to be preserved as the thing evolves. So this is a scheme designed to basically implement canonical quantization on a discrete structure in a well-defined way.
Here, borrowed a slide of Ted's, which I thought very nicely illustrates how we define the phase space for this theory. There are all sorts of different ways you could define it. We just chose one. In this case, we define the set of what we call the half solutions on a given lattice. These are configurations of the field that satisfy the field equations after some specified time, and for which the initial data at that time can't be evolved backwards. So in this way, the configuration only exists as a solution after some time. Here we have phi 1 and phi 2. Phi 1 is born at time t1. Phi 2 is born after that. To define the addition of these configurations requires a little bit of subtlety. You can always add configurations on the lattice, but you in general won't get a solution if the two half solutions were born at different times. So the rule we imposed was that you take the two solutions and you add them together at all the times at which they both exist, and then you take that data and evolve it backwards, you can. So in order for there to be a uniquely defined addition, in order for the addition of the two solutions to be unique, it's necessary that the backwards evolution, if it exists, is also unique. So that happens to be a restriction on the forms of the lattices that we're considering. As I said before, the form of the field equation depends on the structure of the lattice. And so to guarantee unique evolution for a given field equation, we have to restrict to certain types of structures. I guess I should say then that we originally tried to start out doing something that was very general and wild. And we found that in order to make sense of it, we had to keep coming back towards the usual familiar things. So the question of how you define quantum field theory on a general causal set is still a very open question. In this case, the requirement that we had a vector space imposes the restrictions on the types of lattices. Just the idea of having a symplectic product that's conserved under evolution required us to have definite time steps on the lattice. So
if the phis are real, they're real close between minus infinity and plus infinity?
Yeah. Well, field variables.
Okay, they're real numbers.
Real
numbers.
A
complete set of real numbers on the real line.
Yeah. Oh, I see. Yes, yes. Yeah.
If there are a line that you can just simplify that the life as an experiment and just take a discrete phi, and take them on the three values, and then when the lattice goes, you can just take the trace over the discrete values and have and simplify that.
Sounds very good. Yeah, fun is a good word. Yeah, there are a whole lot of things that could be done to generalize the simple model that we considered. We were mostly interested in proving that it could be done for a very simple case. So now we have the symplectic structure, we have the linear vector space, we now have an algebra of observables on that space defined by symplectic structure. You could define a set of linear observables A by for each half solution in the phase space, insert that into the first slot of the symplectic product, and you now have a linear function on the phase space. So we have the set of all such functions defining an algebra, and these will obey these Poisson bracket relations defined by the structure itself. This is, in the continuum case, this can be shown to be equivalent to usual canonical relations where you find commutators between, or Poisson brackets between classical momenta and the position variables, or in this case, the field variables and the field momentum. So, just following Bob Wall's prescription, or description of the prescription, the quantum theory is obtained by simply putting hats on all these, this particular set of objects, and we have an algebra of abstract objects, omega, which obey commutation relations given here, where the this is, you can insert some constant h bar, which we define to be h bar, and here we have the classical symplectic product between phi and psi. All we need to do is add states to this, specify some space of states that act on elements in the algebra, and we have the quantum theory.
The support for your psi's, is it the points or the studs?
The points? Is it the points or the...
Is it the points or the whole studs? A set of points or each point?
The set of points.
Psi on a point?
Psi is
or
a...
Psi
is a configuration of field values on all points on the lattice.
On all points on the lattice?
Yeah, after some birth time. Perfect. Yeah, the vector space that we defined is now, even though the theory was discrete, had a discrete set of points, the vector space is, has a continuum topology. And so everything from this point on is just as it would be for a standard field theory in continuum space, space-time.
What precisely is omega of phi?
Omega of phi is what you get if you take the symplectic product, which acts on two solutions at once, and you fill in one slot with the solution phi. So now this is a function on the phase space, because at every point in the phase space, I merely insert the solution that corresponds to that point into the second slot, and I get some number.
Maybe you should give an example of an omega.
Sure, yeah. Let's imagine that you could say we have some set of points, and there might be links between the points. And consider the initial data, which is zero everywhere on this slice, and it's zero everywhere on this slice except, say, this point right here, where it has phi equals 1. Now if I stick that into the symplectic product, and I evaluate that with any other solution, say psi, what happens for the particular definition of the product that we got is that you get the sum of the average of all the values of psi on all the points that link to this point. So this would be the sum over all these points that it, just call them points x that are in the immediate past of the point we considered p. X in the past of p, the average of psi at all those points. You might have thought that an example of this.
What is psi of x?
What's that?
What is psi?
Psi is another half solution on the lattice.
When you say phi is 1.
Phi is 1.
Doesn't that mean psi is what?
Psi is whatever it is. Psi is a general solution.
Oh, psi is whatever it is.
Yeah, I just take any solution and I skip
it. It's a field.
It's a field. And this product will just give me the average value of these points. You might have wanted to define a variable that was phi at.
If phi is 2, mm-hmm. would psi be increased?
Yeah, this is linear. This is linear in both fields, so you just get 2 times. You might have tried to define an operator. It would be nice to define an operator that was, well, the field value at a specific point. So that, and certainly I can define that as a function on the phase space. For every point in the phase space, I say, what's the value of that configuration at the point x? And this is linear and everything, so it's a very well-defined function as long as the point x, as long as the half solution is defined at that point. But the problem is that, in general, there is a problem in general, which is that in order to define that function in terms of this algebra of elements that I defined here, I need to find some other special solution, I'll call delta of x, such that when I put it in, such that when I put any other solution into the second slot, it tells me what the value of that solution is at that point. But in general, you can't find a half solution that does that on the lattice, which is to say that On the general lattice, this algebra of operators doesn't contain a function that corresponds to the value of the field at a single point. Which is to say that we can't, in general, define the canonical commutation relations in the form of a field operator acting on the momentum, because we don't know how to define it. The symplectic structure gives you a well-defined prescription for defining an algebra between some elements, some functions, but it doesn't tell you what to do with all the functions. So it's the message to take from this is it's kind of strange that we looked at a discrete field theory with a cutoff, and we're unable to define a function on the phase space that corresponds to the value of the field at a point. The best we could do is describe a function that calculates the average value for the field at a region of points. Any questions?
Yeah, it's not clear why you have to be so fancy.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, why it's so tough? What I have in mind is, I mean, just as a first shot, suppose when I drew out the lattice, I could do an adiabatic field, and I would stay in vacuum. But then from my experience in statistical mechanics, I know that the partition function is the Gideon version of the vacuum that I can let them use. And they could trace for the world vacuum.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what I have in mind is an Ising model, but it can be done for a continuous spin also. And it seems to me to be much more straightforward, and then from there I can make Green's functions like the moon sources. So I don't fathom why. And you're getting into a lot of trouble with sounds, because you don't have a well defined field and so on. And so,
well, I think
why are you forced to this?
We do have a well defined field.
Oh, I thought you said that in fact you couldn't define phi and pi and all.
We can define a function on the phase space that just says what's the value of this solution at point x. What we did not see clearly how to define is the Poisson brackets between this function, between those types of functions, the canonical Poisson brackets. We didn't see how to define that. So this fancy stuff alone is a way of skirting around the issue of what is the momentum, what is the field operator. You just have a covariant description of the phase space. And what we get is what we get. So you could come up with a rule, though, that would define those Poisson brackets. And there would be, perhaps by the way you said it. But that would be a different project.
So, but you would expect that after some coarse grading, you would end up with these usual structures.
Mm-hmm.
Will you put this into your model at some point? Will you talk about coarse graining, or is this still an unsolved?
No, I won't talk about coarse graining. But like I did describe the way you could define this function on the phase space, which produces the average value at a set of points. And so we could define that to be under a coarse graining, we could lump all those points together and then if you have field defined at a course point.
It's sort of analogous to the fact that in continuum field theory, the field operator at a point doesn't actually exist in the algebra, but the smeared field operator does.
In the what field operator?
Smeared. Integrated against a compact function of compact support, that's an operator in the algebra, or an element in the algebra. So here, the smearing is just, you know, a discrete sum over some points. But it is a property of this algebra that until you've done that sum, like Brendan just said, you don't have an element of the algebra that we construct.
I have in mind, as he's talking, the Lenniev-Susskind's analysis of the two-dimensional ideal model. You know this. It's a field theory, but it's not expanding. That is, it's one line and then another line and another line, and then it never leads that way and leads that way. And there's coupling between the degrees of freedom on the, among the degrees of freedom on the links. But it seems to me that if each time I make a time jump, I increase by one point and then another point, and I insist that I stay in the vacuum, so I do it adiabatically, then it seems to me I could have a well-defined field theory. You don't know the paper that it's a beautiful paper. It's a takeoff on Amsager, but in field theoretic language. And you get the critical indices of the two-dimensional algebra like that. It's worth taking a look for inspiration.
All right. Let's move on to a actual calculation that we did. We wanted to apply the very nice formal stuff that we put together to an actual situation. So consider a 1 plus 1 dimensional universe with periodic boundary conditions. So you can think of it as a big cylinder. And we start off, the universe is initially static, it undergoes a brief period of growth, and then it's static again at late times. Here I drew a very small universe. There's initially 3 points. It's a very regular. We took the case where the lattice in early and late times is regular null lattice. It's basically like a checkerboard tilted on its corner. And in the middle, there's a little glitch. So you can imagine this extending outwards indefinitely. The question is, then, can we define a sensible notion of particles, particle-like excitations for this, for the in vacuum, for the out vacuum, and what then will be the creation, the excitations due to the growth? In this case, the lattice is regular at early and late times. There's a time translation symmetry, so therefore there are harmonic modes. There is an evolution operator on the lattice, at least at early and late times, which has eigenstates, which can be described in terms of oscillator-like modes on the lattice. Therefore, there seems to be a sensible notion of what we might mean by a particle. But there will be a problem because the in modes don't evolve uniquely through the birth event. And there are modes that just don't exist that are born at the birth time. So we have to face the question of what do we mean by the in vacuum. So how do we specify a vacuum state? We start by, well, again, I'm just following the rules as described by Walt. The idea is to complexify the phase space So now we consider complex linear combinations. You could also just think of it as now we let the field be complex valued at every point. And we define an inner product on this complexified phase space in terms of the symplectic product. Here the bar is complex conjugation. Now, the key thing is to split the phase space into two orthogonal subspaces, one of which is all positive norm solutions, the other of which is all negative norm solutions. Again, the norm is defined in terms of the symplectic product. Different splittings amount to different vacuums. This comes about when we define a set of annihilation operators, one for every positive norm solution in our positive norm subspace. And we could define these in terms of the original algebra of operators that we defined earlier. And then there's we define some state that is annihilated by all of these annihilation operators, one for every point in the positive norm subspace. But then, if we define a different splitting that mixes the positive and the negative norm parts of our initial splitting, we'll have some other set of operators, annihilation operators, for these primed modes, which refers to the second splitting. And in general, those annihilation operators won't annihilate the vacuum that I defined earlier. This is to say, if there is some overlap between this new positive norm, the prime positive norm mode, and the original negative norm modes. So, we ask ourselves, how do you specify the splitting? This can be done by giving a set of linearly independent complex solutions that all have positive norm and that span the space, the positive norm subspace. So in the lattice we're considering, it turns out you can actually solve the field equation to give you the value of the field at any given point, given the values at the previous points. It's just represented by this diamond equation. Here, the field equation amounts to taking the average of the points at up and down and subtracting the average right and left. So this is all on the regular diamond lattice. On that lattice, we can also define null coordinates, which I wrote here as v1 and 2. And there exists a set of harmonic modes that you can define at early times, and then a different set that you can define at late times. In general, if there are C points at a given time, the dimension of the phase space will be 2 times C. So there happens, all right. So the out basis will consist of 2C out harmonic modes. That is, if the late time lattice has C points at any given time, there will be, the dimension of the phase space is 2 times C, and there will be 2C outgoing harmonic modes, which specify a splitting of the phase space. But the in basis, since the lattice is smaller, there are not enough incoming harmonic modes. And so we have to give some more information, which I call here the Burke modes, referring to these solutions that don't exist before the growth event and are born at that time. Also, because the evolution through the birth event is not unique, as it turns out, I have to really specify a point in the phase space. I can give the initial data as being this harmonic mode at early times. Then I have to tell how I evolve it through the birth event. Otherwise, I have not actually specified a single solution. Okay. So to restate this, specifying a state, a vacuum state, amounts to choosing a complete basis of positive norm complex half solutions. Specifying the outcome of choosing the outharmonic modes is okay. Choosing the inharmonic modes is not okay because the basis of in modes is not complete, and it's actually not well defined until I've told you how I extend those modes past the birth time. To complete the specification of the vacuum using the in modes, I have to include some rule that tells you how I evolve it, and I have to specify, I have to choose a particular basis of the modes that are born at the birth time. Different choices give us different states, but it's always the same theory. By this I mean that if I have the A vacuum and I make another choice and I get a B vacuum, the A vacuum is still a state. I choose a vacuum state and then I define a representation of the algebra in terms of excitations of that vacuum state. But if I have an A vacuum and a B vacuum, I have two different sets of excitations. But the A vacuum exists as some excitation of the B vacuum. Okay, so the harmonic modes suggest a particle interpretation, but there's this problem that if two solutions A and B, two positive norm solutions A and B are the same before the birth event, but they evolve to different solutions afterwards, they'll define different annihilation operators, and those operators won't both annihilate the same vacuum in general. So the number of A particles in the B vacuum is not necessarily zero. The point. The great realization that we had when we actually calculated the spectrum of out particles in the in vacuum, or in particles in the out vacuum, is that the late time observer doesn't really care too much. The reason being that however you evolve the inharmonic modes, they won't evolve to a given inharmonic mode, won't evolve to a given out harmonic mode, which is to say that there's no way of choosing the vacuum state so that an in particle is also an out particle and vice versa. This means that we'll always have a lot of outgoing particles if we, for every choice of in vacuum. Qualitatively, we tend to get the same result. This graph here, so we looked at a few different ways of specifying the in vacuum, and then which amounts to different ways of evolving the harmonic modes through birth time. And we then calculated the spectrum of outgoing particles that would be created given that choice of the in vacuum. And this is an example result. Here K is the wave number of the different modes. I think this graph corresponds to a lattice in which there are roughly 1,000 points. This is the log of the number of particles created for a given wave number. And the black line is the total, essentially the total number for that wave number. This is the wave number of the outgoing particles. The red is the contribution to that wave number from the inharmonic modes, and the green is the contribution from the birth modes that arise at that time. So basically, there's a lot of the bulk of the contribution comes from these harmonic modes, and there was no way of that we came across of choosing the evolution of those harmonic modes such that this type of contribution did not arise. That is, however we specified it, we always got a lot of stuff. The fact that most of the contribution comes from harmonic modes also implies that however we chose the different birth modes, it did not have a great effect on the spectrum. So we can then ask, well, what's the total energy created? And it isn't necessarily clear how you define the energy of the lattice. The theory does not have a well-defined Hamiltonian. It has a discrete time evolution operator, which allows us to just guess the naive answer, being that the energy in a given mode is the wave number for that mode times the number of particles, excitations. Right. And what we seemed to find was that as we increased the number of points on the lattice, the energy seemed to diverge in this manner, where here epsilon is the spacing in the lattice, but a better way to think of it is it's inverse to the number of particles. Here we're taking the limit where the net size of the universe is fixed, but we shrink the spacing while increasing the number of sites. So the energy was growing like the number of particles times the log of the number of particles. And if you, this in two dimensions, this corresponds to an energy density, I think, that goes like n squared, which is a lot of energy to have around. And no way we had of fine-tuning the choice of the vacuum led to quantitatively less energy being produced. Well, there are a lot of ways to adjust the model. Either adjusting our specific model or creating one that's similar to it, but in a different vein. Certainly, we should include, for a more physical model, dynamics of the lattice, in particular dynamics between the lattice and the field. Perhaps you could set up a model where all this energy that's created just goes into excitations of the lattice itself.
So when you're talking about lattice dynamics, are you thinking about moving more in the direction of something that would look background independent? Or I don't know if there's a distinction between
what you're talking about. Well, what do you mean by background independent?
So you started out by, I guess this goes back to the question at the beginning, which is what you mean by background lattice.
Uh-huh.
But something we're not laying fields on top of the background.
I guess consider a picture. Here I said, here's the lattice at all times. There's a field defined at all times. But you might consider a situation where the lattice at a given time is, the way it evolves depends on the values of the fields. So the number of points at the next time step and the way the points at the earlier time steps links to those, the way the earlier points link to those later points depends also on the field values. That's a pretty wide open question. There's a lot of different ways I guess you could do it. Does that answer your question?
I think the answer is yes.
Yeah.
Okay.
Right. Multi-point birth. You could imagine instead of creating two points the way we did, you create suddenly a lot of points. If it turns out that the net, the order of magnitude of the energy created is about the same, but the number of points is a whole lot more, then the density of the energy will be much smaller. that would require, actually calculating that in our model would require a more comprehensive computing method. High dimensions, I just considered a two-dimensional universe, you could do it in three or four dimensions. We actually don't know whether the results are qualitatively the same. Although we also do know that on the regular diamond lattices, like the two-dimensional one I defined, but in three and four dimensions, permit unstable solutions. These are solutions that blow up exponentially and also die off exponentially. So the theory is unstable in higher dimensions. But in this case, that's a problem with the particular field equation we define, and is not really a problem with the scheme as a whole. You can also consider an interactive field theory. I'm not exactly sure how to do that. Period. So, as I predicted, we're rather on schedule. I can just conclude by saying if anyone, the model seems robust enough to me to permit a wide class of generalizations, so if anyone is interested in doing that, I'd be interested in hearing how you plan to do it. Thank you.
How far does the fact that you want to have a useful continuum limit of this model put any constraints on the dynamics? I'm not completely clear on this. Has this entered your argument anyway?
I don't think it entered our argument. We were not so concerned with getting the model right in a physical sense. More of just getting a model. But you can make contact with the continuum, I think based on thanks to the abstractness of the definitions of the phase space and the symplectic product, you could, it seems clear to me that those abstract quantities are the discrete analogs of the continuum quantities. And so since the formalism of the theory is the same as a continuum case, that's good. The precise form of the equations, the field equations, you could question whether presumably we didn't get the right answer because there were unstable numbers in higher dimensions.
Well, like you said, that was just a feature of a very particular Lagrangian.
Yeah.
Would it be right to say that the excess energy generation that you find could be due to the fact that the new degrees of freedom are generated in a very abrupt way? I mean, if I use a continuum intuition, it would be really abrupt. They just pop up, basically.
Yep.
And that would be sort of non-adulate.
Yes.
Is that basically intuitively?
Yeah.
But if so, then you would expect that it's quite the same in higher dimension.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
When you have this discrete lattice, it looks like you really have a hard time redefining momentum. And that is, if you have a line,
mm-hmm.
and then points, and then n plus 1 points, and you want a hopping matrix, from the end point of time t1 to the n plus 1 point, and so that's why obviously you do the diamond business and not prejudice yourself. So it becomes really tough. Now, I mentioned the Ising model and what Linnaeus Fiskin did was he took an extreme anisotropic Ising model so that the coupling in the vertical direction is extremely strong as compared to the coupling of the spins in the horizontal direction. And therefore, because it's extremely strong, if you go from one line to the next, you only flip one spin. And so and that's the DDT. The DDT is what you get when you flip one spin at a time. So without the expanding lattice, the momentum just comes from taking one line and then another line in which one spin is different, and that defines the momentum at the point pi of a line, because you have a spin there, you go to either the same thing, and then you can just do one spin flip on the next line, and that defines the momentum at the point I, and that's well defined. And then you keep on going, and he solved this problem exactly in terms of Hamiltonian formalism. And now, perhaps, if you take that model and you go to n plus 1 points, because you only flip one spin at a time, you get into less trouble. You know what I mean? That because I'm in sympathy with the diamond idea, but it wouldn't complicate life so much if you just flip one spin at a time. And it might help, and it might be able conceptually to introduce the idea of an adiabatic vacuum that you can stay in vacuum because you're only flipping one spin at a time from one line to the next, and you might get a stable vacuum. Because from what I understand, one of the troubles is you're not getting a stable vacuum from this epsilon log epsilon business. So we can take a look at it.
Obviously,
this isn't the way to do the discussion, but it's a highly technical thing.
Maybe an aspect of what you're saying is that, see, what Brendan and I did was we tried to just describe a self-contained field theory. Field is not an effective description of the microscopic degrees of freedom. It is the degrees of freedom, which maybe is just, you know, a totally different approach, which is probably more valid by far physically, is that at the lattice level, the degrees of freedom have nothing to do with the field theory. And therefore implementing canonical commutation relations of the field at the lattice level is not the right thing to do.
But for the Ising model, you can
right.
do it.
But then there's some effective field that evolves.
In this extreme anisotropic limit, you do get the concept of momentum.
Well, you have to show me that reference. I have a question about one thing you said. Interactions on a list of extensions. Is there any? Can you just make a 5/4 field theory on this two-dimensional lattice without anything you said falling apart? Can it just extend? Or is there some obstruction to? I mean, not that you could calculate as easily, but is the theory well defined if you just put it in an interaction term?
I'm just a local phi I to the 4.
Yeah, like an analog of 5/4 theory.
Why not?
Continue.
Yeah, I guess so. Sure. I mean, the calculation of creation of particles totally different, but the first half of the talk, the definitions and the constructions, the algebras, same thing.
Wait,
similar.
Don't you need to know something about the dynamic?
in order to be able to say that the proximal structure is preserved or something like that? And do you still know what the proximal structure is that is preserved?
Well, I could retain the same structure, synthetic structure. It would be conserved in this case if it's just a non-derivative coupling. And then I suppose just calculate in the interaction. Well, I open up my book on Feynman and then look at how to calculate the interaction representation.
And the 5 to the 4, if you do the Eitring model and you do with a discrete spin plus or minus, then you can do a trick by Gaussian integration and convert the discrete spins to field phi I, which span the whole real axis from minus infinity to plus infinity. And when you do that, when you do the integration, in addition to the obvious things like grad phi I squared, you get a polynomial in phi I. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you know that. And you get a model with a phi I for a fixed lattice. And now you can see what happens if it expands.
And can you consider a contracting lattice, which would be like a contracting phase of bouncing? Yeah.
No problem. You just have to change some of the definitions. In fact, it would just be the time reverse of what we looked at. I think with enough subtlety, you could consider something that was generally contracting and expanding.
Would you reach a minimal number of points in the lattice which would correspond to the minimal size of a bouncing model in the continuous limit?
Since there's no dynamics of the lattice you could just go all the way down to one point. There's no reason for there to be a restriction before that. I suppose you could imagine that there are no points after that one point. But then I don't know what you have.
I kind of remember, Brendan, you'll remember this better, but at one point we did wonder if you had solutions that only existed for a finite interval of time. Would that be the generic situation if you had expansion and contraction? And I thought we ran into some problem that was just totally blocked us. We needed them to exist semi-infinitely, but I can't remember why.
Well, I guess it's because you wouldn't know how to define the addition of two solutions that didn't overlap.
Oh yeah, this way, that's it. So any two solutions eventually overlap in your domain of definitions. And that was crucial to just defining a vector space of solutions, right?
Yeah, yes. But even in the case where the lattice is doing whatever, you could still consider the set of all configurations that exist throughout all that wiggle and define it that way.
But then you couldn't follow your Waldian.
Yeah, you could, but you wouldn't have creation of modes or destruction of modes. You just have modes that existed at all times. So it wouldn't be so interesting.
Sorry, what did you say? How would you avoid creation and destruction?
Well, what I just said was you define the phase space to be the set of all configurations that are solutions at all times.
You just reject the ones that don't exist for all times.
Yeah. No. So that you don't have to worry about them not overlapping.
Yeah, but that's not what you were after.
Right.
I think that's a really valid point, that if it seems like, so like Brendan said, to just even get off the ground, you had to be very restrictive on the properties of this lattice. And if you ask for what you just asked for, that there could also be contraction in the same universe that there's
expansion in. As we did it, I think our scheme collapses. And we can't. And so, in terms of its physical implication, it would mean either that, this is a hint that the microscopic structure doesn't admit such a recollapse or something, or it's just an inadequate scheme. It's probably the second possibility. It's a good point.
If there are no further questions, let us thank you.